This is Leonard Lofty Tyson, recorded at his home at Edenthorpe, near Doncaster, by Chris Eldon Lee on the 8th of December 2009. Lofty Tyson, Part 1.
Leonard Charles Tyson was born in Kirksandle, near Doncaster, next village to here, on the 20th of August 1923.
So you're now 86
years
old. Yeah. And where did the name Lofty come from then?
Well, this goes back to when I first thought of joining FIDS. I'd got a... Now, let's see. At the time I saw the advert for FIDS, needing wireless operator mechanics for service in the Antarctic, I was doing a course at Hull Tech to get a certificate to go to sea as a ship's radio officer. Now, I applied for this FIDS job as a result of seeing an advert in a magazine, and I got an appointment for a Monday, and this coincided with my passing out exam at Hull Tech, which the exams had started on Friday and were due to continue on Monday. But the chief instructor, when I told him I'd got this interview, he arranged for the examiner to come and examine me and a mate of mine on the Saturday. So we did, and I went down to do the interview.
How old would you have been, Lofty?
Well, I got demobbed on my 30th birthday, or a month afterwards, and that was in 53. So this was, I'd have been 31, just before my 32nd birthday. And having got this job with FIDS, I was then working as an electrician's mate at Rockwell Glass Company on a temporary basis until the ship sailed. And then I got this invite down to Cambridge to go and see and meet some of the people who were going round and being interviewed on what was in for me. So I went down on my motorbike, and as usual, I got lost in Cambridge and I couldn't find the Scott Polar Institute. So I was late. And when I got in there, I just joined the mob who were being shown sledges and husky dogs and so on. And then we were all being called in for an interview in one of the rooms off the of the building. I don't know where it was now. And there's this man there sat at one side of a desk with a tape recorder, and I sat down at the other, and he interviewed me. It never struck me at the time, but I just assumed he was from FIDS doing an interview, but it turned out he was from the BBC. Well, during the course of his conversation, he asked me, did I have any nicknames? So I said, no, as far as I can remember, it's always been Len or Tyson. I might have been called Lofty if I got out of step on the parade ground when I was in the rep or something like that, but otherwise, no, it was always Lofty. It's never been Lofty, it was just Len. So that was it. And he also asked me a few more questions. One of them was, what do you expect to find when you get down there? So I said, a bit of peace and quiet. And then when I got down there, I was forwarded a copy from the Rockwire magazine, in which it said that the author knew it was noisy in the works, but didn't think it was noisy enough to drive anybody to the Antarctic for a bit of peace and quiet. But anyhow, as I say, I didn't know this recording was for the BBC. But on the John Biscoe going out, Bill Anderson was doing recordings, and I discovered then that this was for a programme the BBC were going to broadcast called Expedition South, and they were following our years people down there and see how they got on. Well, of course, he did a few recordings on the boat on the way down there, but I didn't know when these things were being broadcast. And when we got to Stanley, I wasn't going down on the Biscoe's first trip south, so I was offloaded in Stanley, and I was working in the Met office as a relief operator. And when I got up to the Met office, I found they had 3 transmitters and 2 receivers. They had 2 transmitters and 1 receiver out of action. So my first job was to get them working. But anyhow, I settled in Stanley for a month, and one evening we were invited to a party at Arthur Martin's, and this Expedition South programme was broadcast over the local radio. So that was the first time I heard it. And on it, the man said, "Arthur Martin, Bill Anderson tells me Lofty Tyson is the Casanova of the Biscoe," with a phone ringing every few minutes with one of the local damsels wanting a few words with him. And that's the first time I knew I was being called Lofty Tyson. But you can imagine the reception I got when I got to the party. But
was that true? Were you the Casanova of the Biscoe?
No. No, what happened was when we docked in the early hours of the morning, as soon as the post office was open, I went ashore with the donkey man to collect the ship's mail. And when we got, I'm going to prove myself a liar here. When we got to the post office, the man behind the counter said to me, "Are you Lofty Tyson?" I hadn't been ashore for more than 10 minutes, so I admitted it. Anyhow, on the way back to the ship, we met a woman who the donkey man knew because he'd worked in Stanley before he'd joined the Biscoe. So he stopped to talk to her and I went on back to the ship. I didn't take any notice. I couldn't, you know, I didn't know what she looked like or anything. Anyhow, when he was taking his stint as, I suppose he'd been the gangway observer or whatever the equivalent was, whenever he was on duty, he phoned her because she worked in the telephone exchange. And on this first occasion, he yelled down the fiddery steps, "Lofty, Valerie wants a few words with you." "Who the hell is Valerie?" So anyhow, I went up, and by the time I'd got there, she'd rung off. So this became the thing. Whenever he was on duty, he'd speak to her and he'd yell down the stairs, but she was never there when I got up. So, of course, all the feds cottoned on to this, so every time the phone rang, they'd yell, "Lofty, Valerie wants you." So anyhow, on the Sunday, I can't remember now, it's the first or the second Sunday, they had the cinema shows in the town hall. And he yelled down, "Valerie wants you to take her to the cinema tonight." So I wasn't going to the cinema, but anyhow, I let them all get off to the cinema, and I thought, damn it, there's only one way to put a stop to this lark. I'll go and meet her. And I hadn't a clue what she looked like. So I went to the tea shop and looked round at all the women in there, and she blushed. So I said, I believe I'm supposed to take you to the cinema. Are you ready? So we went. Now, I don't know whether you've ever been to the cinema in the town hall, but the entrance to the town hall is at one end, opposite to the stage. The projector was on the stage and the screen was in above the entrance, and the chairs were set out in two lots with an aisle down the middle. Well, of course, not knowing my way around, I was letting her lead me in. She walked right up the middle. And of course, as soon as we got level with the first row of chairs, all the fids were sat up on the stage in the expensive seats, and they all burst into applause. And of course, as soon as that happened, the idea spread and the whole audience burst into applause. So she sat down on the first available seat, and I sort of acknowledged the applause and went and sat down next to her. So that was that. That was how I came to be called the Casanova of the Lost.
So who was Valerie?
Valerie Craigie Halkett. She later married one of the forecasters out there. What was his name? He'd been out there before, but he came out again while I was out there. Well, that was later on, after I came up from south.
She was a Falklander, was she?
Oh, yes. Mm.
Attractive?
Yes. I wasn't particularly attracted, to be quite honest, but
she wasn't the one that got away then.
Hmm?
She wasn't the one that got away.
Oh no.
And this was all happening in 1950.
This was December 54.
December 54. So that radio program would have gone out in about the same time.
Yes. Yeah. It was. It became infamous as Exhibition Mouth, because Bill Anderson didn't take it seriously.
You don't remember any names of the presenter or...?
He was quite a well-known one. I can't remember his name now. I did write to him, but I didn't get a reply. Mm. Probably because I was being rude to him.
Oh, OK. Well,
the result of labelling me the Casanova of the Biscay.
Let's go back a bit, can we? And tell me a bit about your education. Where were you? Where, which school did you go to? What was your education like, Lofty?
Well, I was born in Kirksandel, so I went to the infant and the junior school there, which is the next village here. And then I went to Armthorpe Senior School. And then I went to Junior Tech in Doncaster till I was 16. And I think I surprised the form master in each case, because when it became known at Armthorpe that I was taking the entrance exam for the ref, the form master gave me a telling off, to put it mildly, for not telling him so that he could have given me some homework. He says, "You've not a cat in hell's chance of passing." So I think there were three people from the school sat this exam, and I passed highest. Then at the Tech, I'd taken the entrance exam before the end of the term, and the form master came into a machine drawing lesson looking for me, because I'd had a phone call from the gasworks to say they'd got a vacancy for an apprentice, and he thought I'd be suitable. So, of course, as it happened, I was out relieving myself when he came in, so somebody said he's going to join the RAF. So his reply to that was apparently, if he passes. So he didn't bear much chances. And I did pass, so I did join the RAF as an aircraft apprentice.
What year was that?
1939.
Rather auspicious year.
Yeah, we joined at Halton on the 22nd of August. And we moved to Cranwell on the 29th. And war was declared on the 3rd, on the Sunday. So,
do you remember when you joined the RAF, were you expecting there to be a war?
It looked highly likely, yes.
But you still went ahead?
Oh, yeah. I was only 16. In fact, I was 16 and 2 days when we joined up. But, I joined as an apprentice wireless electrical mechanic. And then when war broke out, there was some debate whether they were going to keep apprentices on, because it was a three-year course. And then they decided to keep us on. In fact, they brought extra in, and it was the biggest entry ever. And this three-year course was reduced to 2 years. And then after a month or two, training as a WOM, it was changed to WOM, wireless operator mechanic, instead of wireless electrical mechanic. So then in January 41, we were due to pass out in September, but in January we were supposed to be passed out straight away because there was a shortage of WOMs. Anyhow, the powers that be at the school pointed out that the last 6 months of the course was going to be the most crucial, so they extended it for 6 months. So instead of passing out in September, I passed out and got posted on 3rd of June. So our three-year course was reduced to basically 18 months.
Why wireless, Lofty? Were you attracted to the radio?
Well, I thought it sounded like the easiest of the options. There were engine fitters, airframe fitters, armourers, instrument makers, and wireless electrical mechanics. So that seemed to be the most interesting one of the lot.
But had you done some toying around as a boy?
No.
No?
No.
No crystal set?
No. No, I hadn't a clue on radio or electrics.
And did you stay with the RAF throughout the duration of the war?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was on a 12-year engagement from 18. So I passed out 2 months before I was 18. So I did my 12 years. And then because of the Korean conflict, demob was delayed for a month. So I did 12 years and 1 month from 18. By that time, I was doing a resettlement course at Hull Tech to get my PNG certificate to go to sea as a ship's radio officer. I never did, but it stood me in good stead to get this job with FIDS.
It's a big question, but do you think that those 12 years with the RAF helped you prepare yourself for life with FIDS?
Oh, yeah.
And if so, in what way?
Well, basically, I got used to living with other people. And also, I got used to working with radio gear and odd hours, being on call whenever. Oh, yes. Oh, no regrets about my RAF career, except that I went to air crew, and having been rejected as a WOM AG, wireless operator mechanic air gunner, which would have been on coastal command, I was rejected at the interview without any questions being asked beyond, "What are you in for?" I said, "WOM AG," and he said, "You're too tall." So he said, "Have you considered going for PNB, pilot, navigator, or bomb aimer?" So I said, I didn't think my education would be good enough. So he said, would you like to try? So I did, and I was accepted. And then we got accelerated entry to train as a NBW, Navigator Bomber Wireless. Well, neither me nor anybody in the orderly room had ever heard of this trade, but we worked it out. There was only one aircraft that used a Navigator Bomber Aimer Wireless as a Mosquito. And of course, that was the most attractive aircraft for any non-pilot. You either flew so high that if anything happened, you had a chance to get out, or so low that it was all over too quick, so you didn't know about it. Mm. So I trained as a NAVW, and then came redundant at the end of the war and got posted back in my ground trade as an instructor to Compton Bassett at a radio school. I didn't know I was supposed to be there permanent staff, so I did a couple of weeks on the course with the rest of the Herberts that had gone down with me, and I was sent for by the chief instructor, where have you been for the last fortnight? And I was on course so-and-so, sir. He said, you weren't sent here to do the course, you were sent here permanent staff. So the following week I was taking my old class as an instructor.
So you saw some active service during the war?
No, I had a very quiet war.
Oh, okay.
I was training, then I had 2 years sat on my behind on a transmitting station, watching two transmitters, one in use and one standby. And then I went air crew and then went all over the place doing various courses, ITW. Babbacombe, Cranwell for a refresher, key bashing course, and then where did we go from there? Oh, then we went off to Canada, did a navigation course, came back, discovered they weren't using NAVWs in any quantity, so they didn't know what to do with us, so they sent us out on to ITWs, flying round in Tiger Moths, map reading familiarisation. And then I did a senior NCO's course. And then they decided they'd send us to Coastal Command. We were to become radar operators. Mm. The fact that there was a shortage of straight navigators on Bomber Command, but they were training them as navigator radio. And we'd done wireless. But they didn't consider us for that, so we were to go on to Coastal Command. So I did a Coastal Command pre-OTU signals course, and then the war finished, became redundant, and I went back, and then I discovered it. Well, I decided I didn't want to be an instructor, so I failed the instructor's technique course, applied for a posting overseas, anywhere but the Middle East. So then when I finished up on the Canal Zone, I was living in a tent there for a year. And then they had a restructuring, and I was told that my permanent rank would be corporal. But in the meantime, I still kept my aircrew rank. And then I got stuck back on flying again. And so I was on MedMECOM squadron flying in Anson's and Dakotas. And then on a trip to Nairobi, I met a man who'd been an apprentice with me and who'd also done his aircrew training with me. And he was on 13 squadron flying Mosquito photo reconnaissance aircraft. So he asked me if I'd like to get on transferred to the squadron, and we discovered we were both based at Fayed, but he was on detachment to Nairobi, and I was just delivering an Anson to to Nairobi. And so anyhow, when I got back to Nairobi, I did one more trip, and I came back and found myself posted to 13th Squadron. So he told me all about the PR job in half an hour and 10 minutes in the cockpit of a mosquito sat in the sun. And so I became a PR navigator.
PR?
Photographic reconnaissance.
So you never flew a plane as such?
Oh, no. I was just a navigator.
Yeah. Let's just fast forward then to this seeing this advert in the magazine. You don't remember the name of the magazine?
It was probably Wireless World. I don't know.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. And you went for this. What made you want to go to the Antarctic? Had you read about it as a boy, or?
Well, let's go back to my aircrew career. While I was on 13th Squadron, we went down to Nairobi to do a job from there. And that was beginning of June. And we had two attempts. We couldn't take the photographs because of cloud. And then the plane ran out of flying hours, so it had to be overhauled. Then when it was ready, we took off to go and take these photographs again, but we only got a few hundred yards off the end of the runway and crashed. The pilot was killed. I don't know how I got out, but I spent 3 months in an army hospital there, and then I got invalided home and spent a year in the hospital at Halton. So then when I came out of hospital, I'd gone in as a warrant officer, navigator. I went to Innsworth, which was a holding unit. Well, they got me sorted out, and then I got posted to Finningley.
To where?
Finningley, just across the road here, 8 miles away, as an acting corporal, warm. So I arrived there with two requests for, grievance. On the grounds that I should have kept my rank and pay for 6 months after being grounded. Alternatively, under the terms I'd gone aircrew, I should have been returned. In the rank and pay, it's calculated I would have attained had I remained in my ground job. So they were both... I was promoted from acting corporal to substantive corporal and got a posting to Southern Rhodesia. So, I had 15 months out with injuries, burns. So, sorry, now, get back. What
was your first inkling of the Antarctic, and why did you decide you wanted to go?
Oh, that's right, you asked me. Well, while I was in hospital, I was an avid reader, and I think I read every book on the Antarctic they had in the library. Because I thought, I read lots of other books, of course, but I got quite interested. So I thought, when I saw the advert, I thought, well, that's a part of the world I wouldn't normally see, and it should be interesting, so we'll have a bash. So I did.
So you'd heard about Scott and...
Oh, yeah.
The heroes.
Yeah.
Who had learned before your time, of course.
Oh, yeah, much before my time. Mm. Yeah.
And what was the interview like when you went to FIDS to be interviewed?
To be quite honest, I don't remember anything at all about it. I know I have a vague idea where it was, and I know from there I had to go to Harley Street for a medical, but I couldn't tell you who was there or anything about it.
Do you think the fact that you'd done that period of time in the RAF stood you in good stead?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Were they actually looking for ex-servicemen?
Well, let's face it, at that time, practically everybody was ex-service.
Yeah.
On the base, we had Ron Napier, ex-Marines, Harry Dolman, ex-Navy, Lance Tickell, Army.
Jim Shercliffe.
Jim Shercliffe, ex-Air Force. Now, what's his name? Another ex-army bloke. The only one who hadn't seen any service was John Bull, the diesel mate. And so, you know, there's never any conflict because we're all used to living with other people, which we were fortunate. But, of course, in them days, practically everybody in their early 20s had done either served during the war or were doing national service. So,
of course, yes. So you ended up going south on the old Biscoe.
Yeah.
What was she like?
Bloody terrible.
In what respect?
Well, we'll put it this way. We boarded her in the afternoon and we sailed and had tea, or the evening meal, I can't remember what they called it. And having done that, went up on deck just as we were passing the needles and I got rid of it over the side. And I was seasick every day from there to Montevideo. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I wasn't violently seasick, but I was seasick every day. But we had chores to do on board, and I did my share there. But I was not happy on there.
Did she roll a lot? Was that the problem?
Yes. You know anything about the old Biscoe?
Well, nobody liked her very much.
Mm-hmm.
Most people I ask that question of give me the same kind of answer.
Yeah, well, it was a US-built harbour defence thing. I think it was about 800 tons, wooden built, round bottomed, so it rolled a lot, and it wasn't very big, and it wasn't very comfortable. And the Fiddery was the old hull, old hold, and there's no ventilation. There was the usual spout up, but no, didn't get much there. And at the top of the stairs, they don't call them stairs on ships, do they? Top of the gangway from the Fiddery and across the passage was the kitchens. So it was not very, very comfortable or well ventilated at all.
Have they described to you the work you'd be doing when you got south?
Not that I recall. No, I just assumed I'd be a wireless operator mechanic. I mean, the name specifies it, doesn't it?
So you didn't know you were going to go to Sydney initially?
Oh, I had no idea where I was going. That was sorted out when we got to Stanley.
Mm.
In Stanley, we got kitted out, interviewed. I think we met the governor as well. A vague idea going to a cocktail party there. But... yeah. Oh, and then we were doing chores, filling sandbags with gravel and sand to take down for building. And then, as I say, I was stuck there for a month while she went down to the other bases. Yes.
So what did it make of your new home when you finally arrived at Sydney early in 55?
I thought it was rather depressing. The old hut was primitive, and it had built in bits. And it originally built by a handyman from the Met Office, as I discovered later. There were two handymen working at the Met Office when I went back to Stanley, and each of them had done a stint at Sydney in the early days, building the place. But,
was that the general impression? You think that other people also were a bit despondent about what they saw?
I don't know about being despondent. I think we knew we were there to build a new base up by this time. So I think we all agreed that we needed a new base.
It couldn't be any worse.
No. Yeah. Well, I suppose it could have been, yeah. It must have been in the first year, because it was just the basic hood before they'd got the additions on them, and they got added a kitchen and a diesel room and a bit more. And, of course, the toilets was outside, which was always a problem if you needed to go out there. You did have a good view from there, though, out across the Coronation.
How did you go about building this new hut, then? What do you remember of that process? I appreciate it's a long time ago now.
Yeah. Well, basically, the Biscoe's holes were full of this new hut, because it had come down to Stanley on a different ship.
This is going to be Chonersburg House, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was it? It's a kit form, was it?
I suppose it was. It had all been pre-assembled, and all the joints were cut, and the timbers were labelled. So it was in bundles of timber. You know, you get a bundle of 4x2s and a bundle of tongued and grooved, and these were all labelled. The only snag is we didn't. Well, as you can imagine, on a hut, I think it was 70 foot long and 36 wide or something like that, there's a lot of timber. And the framework had all been cut and tongued and grooved and pre-assembled and then dismantled and packed up. So we had the overall plans showing what went where. The individual bundles, we didn't know what were in them until we unpacked them.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, I had to decide where to build the hut. And it was built on the site of an old whaling factory. So the ground was uneven. At one end of the hut, we must have been about 6 or 8 feet above ground level. At the other end was probably about 18 inches or so. So we had to build pylons at the living end of the hut to build it. And the other end, where the diesel shed and the coal store were, that was solid concrete. Well, we filled that end up with rocks and an old iron from the remnants of the whaling station. So we were, the Biscoe stayed behind while we were doing this, and the crew and the other transient Fids were all labour gangs working on this lot. Then they went off and left two of the previous year's men, two Smiths actually, and they'd volunteered to stay and help with the building. And then we got on with the building between us, and eventually got it all built up. Then the Biscoe came back and gave us a bit more help.
Was it an easy job to build it?
Hardly. As I say, it was about 70 foot long. So we had to get the framework up first, framework for the floor first, then put the flooring boards down, and that was double thickness, tongued and grooved, with a layer of roofing felt between them, if I remember correctly. So there's a lot of nails to be knocked in. And knocking nails in when it's cold and usually damp can be a bit damaging on the fingers. So that took a while. And then once we got the floor done, then we had to assemble the frame. So that involved unpacking bundles of timber to find the right labelled bits to go where you wanted them. So that was time consuming. That's when I came to kill my first penguin. I was undoing bundles of timber on the beach and everybody else was up at the building. And as one does, I got into conversation with this penguin who was watching my antics with some curiosity. And suddenly I noticed that all the work had stopped. So I turned around to see what was going on. And somebody yelled, "Don't stand there talking to the bloody thing, kill it." "What, me?" "Yeah. What with? You've got a hammer in your hand." So I walked over to this gentoo penguin. "Sorry about this, mate," bashed it over the head. That's the first penguin I killed.
Was that for food?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, they weren't plentiful, weren't they?
Oh, yeah.
They were?
Yeah. Not particularly round the base, but we just used to get the odd one, being a bit curious about these peculiar creatures ashore, and they'd come up.
Did anything go wrong with building the hut? Normally when you get a kit, there's a bit missing, isn't there?
No, I think all that was missing was the list of what was in each timber bundle.
Right.
No. So I can't remember now. I think it was about April when we finally got enough of the hut built to move into. We got the kitchen, the bunk room, the radio room, the Met office, and I think we'd got the sitting room, I'm not sure about that, done, and we moved in. And as originally planned, the lavatory was at the end of the hut, and next to that was a wireless cabin. So it wasn't very long before I objected because the smell was terrible. So then they built an extension on the hut and moved the lavatory out. And then the old lavatory became the egg store.
Became the?
Egg store.
Egg store.
Yeah. Because we used to go out and collect penguin eggs.
And what was the hut like to live in? Was it?
Oh, it was nice and comfortable.
Was it?
Once it was finished. Yeah.
Warm?
Most of it. Well, the part that we lived in, yes. Because we... Of course, the kitchen, the range was always on. There was heat stoves in the bedroom and the living room. And in the workshop. And the workshop one heated the water for the bathroom. But where there was no stove, of course, it did get rather chilly.
Are you proud of it?
Oh, yes, yeah. In fact, there's a bit of it on the chair behind your chair. There's a chunk of wood there behind the wood.
How did that get back to Edenthorpe?
Hmm?
How did that get to Edenthorpe, that piece of wood?
Well, they demolished the building and took it back. And Lance Tickell was there when they were demolishing it, so he got a piece of wood for all of us with the stamp on it. So get it up afterwards. So he presented us all with a souvenir of the house.
There was some sort of crest on this hut, wasn't there?
Yes, I think. I have a sneaking suspicion I might have been responsible, not for that, but for the idea.
Can you elaborate for me?
Yeah, well, midwinter, of course, is always a big celebration down there. Jim Shurtcliffe and Harry Dolman made a midwinter cake in half a flour tin, which was a very large cake. And I was duty cook for midwinter, because, of course, in them days we didn't have a base cook. We did it in turns a week about. So I had to decorate this cake. Well, I'd never decorated a cake in my life, but I got the marzipan all right, because we had some ground almonds. And then it came to the icing, and I made the mistake of mixing the icing sugar with water and put it on. And you shouldn't do that, because it just doesn't set, it doesn't dry. So after 2 days, I stuck it in the oven to dry it. Then, of course, I had to decorate it. So there was some almond paste left over, so I came up with the idea of making a Sydney Island presentation of two elephant seals rampant in a sea of shit. And so I did that, and I put the semper in excreta on the side. So this seemed to go down well. So John Bull took up the idea, and he got a piece of plywood, and he painted this crest on it, and elaborated it a bit, made a proper crest out of it, and stuck it up on the side of the hut. So it stayed there until, I don't know why it was taken down. I think somebody had a bout of conscience and thought we'd better have it down when the Bisco comes back. I can't remember whether the governor was on board or not. Anyhow, they took it down, but it went back up as soon as the ship had gone. And I think it remained there for some years. In fact, it became a feature of the place.
Do you know what happened to it in the end?
No. No, it probably, like all plywood, deteriorated and got dumped.
So you spent almost a year in this house, or 9 months anyway, didn't you?
Yeah, I think we moved in March or April, I can't remember now. Mm. And then I went out in January.
The following January, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Now, what about the radio? You had to establish a radio base, I presume.
Oh, well, that was already in operation. I mean, the previous year they'd always had radio on the base. So it was just a case of moving it from one up to the other.
Well, that sounds very simple. I bet it wasn't.
No, there were big transmitters. Came down on a sledge. There wasn't much snow either when it happened. No, the big problem there was getting the masts up, because we had 2 30-foot steel masts to put up. No problem if you got the manpower on flat ground, but we didn't have any flat ground. So each guy was a different length, and so that was a bit of a problem. But fortunately, Ron Napier and
I'll pause.
Yeah.